WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. One of the growing debates in foreign policy today is whether our trade policies with countries should be tied to their human rights records. At the center of the debate is China, whose most favored nation trade status is up for renewal in June. Many human rights groups want President Clinton to pressure China to ease up in Tibet. China invaded Tibet in 1950. Since then, the Chinese have destroyed much of the culture and religion of Tibet. About 6,000 temples and shrines have been demolished. An estimated 1 million people have died as a result of the occupation. Those who speak out face imprisonment and torture. My guest Orville Schell reports on Tibet in a documentary that will be broadcast tonight on the Frontline series on most PBS stations. Schell is the author of 8 books about China, including Discos and Democracy. He's vice chairman of the human rights group Asia Watch. When Schell went to Tibet, he pretended to be a tourist, not a journalist.
It's very difficult to go as a member of the press. The Chinese do have a way of viewing, of equating the press with outside intruders, with all sorts of subversive elements, and it's a very tricky thing to get into Tibet. And when you do get in as a member of the press, it's usually in a group, and you're monitored very carefully. So we simply went in as tourists, and we did pretty much what tourists do, but just kept our ears to the ground.
So you took your video with home video camera?
We took a Hi8 camera and went in and took the route that tourists normally take and talked to people along the way and tried to make some sense out of what we were seeing.
I noticed some of the people you interviewed had scarves tied around their faces, so you couldn't tell who they were. Is it dangerous to talk to the press?
It's extremely dangerous for Tibetans. The whole question of Tibetan independence is one that causes just unbelievable tension between Tibetans and Chinese. And it harkens back to China's claim over Tibet, which goes back many centuries and is a very convoluted sort of argument as to who has rights to who. But it gets to the heart of the Chinese sensitivity about the dismemberment of their empire that they now call the motherland. And any errant piece of territory such as Tibet or Xinjiang or Mongolia that gives birth to these independence movements tends to create tremendous feelings of animosity and counter-reactions from Peking.
As you say in your documentary, to the West, Tibet has been seen as a Shangri-La. What has Tibet's place been historically in terms of Buddhism and culture?
Well, I think Tibet, at least for the outside world, seemed to be a place where all the normal forces of life, the normal forces of sort of earthly gravity came to a stop. It was a place where we could all project our fantasies, this sort of Buddhist wonderland, this mythic region beyond the mountains. And in that sense, it tended to evoke our projections, which we often mistook for the real place. So everybody had a kind of a view of what Tibet, this mythical place, must be. Whether if you were a missionary, it was souls to save. If you were a diplomat in the grand game of the 19th century, it was a piece of territory to be anchored against Russia or Britain or whomever. In more recent times, the Chinese had their own sort of most fevered projection, which was this was a place in need of liberation, a la the revolution of Mao Zedong. Namely, that society needed to be turned over and need to be defeudalized and remade in order for Tibet to breathe.
You say that no belief system could have been more at odds with Tibetan Buddhism than Maoism. Explain the conflict.
Well, just think about it. What is Tibetan Buddhism all about? It subscribes to a view of the world which says that the battle of life is in the soul. To keep one's soul pure in a state of sort of karmic cleanliness so that it can be reincarnated into a higher life form and ultimately to attain nirvana. So this is a very interior kind of view of what life's meaning is all about. On the other hand, Maoists and the Chinese communists view the meaning of life as a struggle outside of the self, outside of the individual and the soul and society, to reshape society, to make it more equal, more just, and to turn over the feudal elements such as landlords and capitalists, and it involves this sort of cataclysmic struggle within the world. So these two views came to clash in Tibet when the People's Liberation Army marched in 1950, and I think even today, when one is in Lhasa or anywhere in Tibet for that matter, one has very little sense that either side, you know, understands the other or kind of gets the whole interior logic of the other side's notion of liberation. They just sort of sail by each other.
Well, do you have a sense of how Tibetan Buddhism and the monasteries look from the Chinese communist perspective?
Well, yes. I mean, this is one of the things that I, as somebody who's studied China for so many years, was very interested in looking into. Namely, what was China's view? What do they think they're doing up there? I mean, they've taken some terrible black eyes. It's cost them enormous amounts of wealth and bad publicity. And in short, besides fleshing out the motherland and protecting what they view as the territorial integrity of their country, they see themselves in almost evangelical terms as going into this benighted, primitive, backward society where the monks and the aristocrats kept states and that were kept going by feudal serfs. So their vision of Tibet was a society of gross inequity that didn't work, that should be smashed and refashioned. But I think, you know, what they missed was the fact that in some spiritual way, Tibetan Buddhism and the whole theocratic system really did work for Tibetans and made them basically content in some way that was inexplicable to the Maoist sort of vision of how society should be.
The Chinese, during their occupation, destroyed about 6,000 monasteries and temples. What is the point of destroying the temples?
Well, the Chinese viewed the monastic system in Tibet, and Tibetan Buddhism for that matter, as nothing more than superstition, as a kind of a backward system of belief that was retarding this country, that was keeping it locked in a time warp, preventing it from industrializing, you know, from modernizing, and from joining the revolutionary movement, which Peking very much saw itself a center of. So they just saw these things as emblems that of a world that had no right to exist, and they set about dismantling them in the most sort of brutal and destructive way.
Some of the Buddhists who you interviewed are talking about taking up guns, which is an amazing thing considering that, you know, Buddhism is about contemplation and compassion and nonviolence. And it makes you wonder if it's possible for that kind of religion to survive with its values intact when the country isn't isolated from the world.
Well, this is a real problem, and it was very interesting for me to see how many Tibetans feel so desperate that really they can't imagine any other solution besides taking up weapons. And I think they perceive armed struggle not as a realistic way to gain independence or to gain more autonomy, but as a way to attract attention from the world, which is really the only hope that they have of pressuring China. And of course, the Dalai Lama sitting in Dharamsala in India is very much opposed to this idea, but it comes as somewhat of a surprise to find that even within his camp, his government, and Tibetans in exile, there's a great split now over what measures Tibetans should take to force the Chinese to pay attention and force the world to pay attention to what they consider to be an occupation of their country.
So what kind of thinking did that lead you to about what happens to a religion that's about contemplation and nonviolence when it confronts tyranny and torture.
Well, you know, I think my overwhelming feeling of being in Tibet was one of a great tragedy. Of it's like a really rotten marriage, you know, where people just don't understand each other. And you can have all the counseling and negotiations, and it still doesn't help because it's a fundamental gap in perception. And what's now, I think, even more tragic about Tibet is that whereas it has been a political problem that could have been solved readily, easily if the Chinese and Tibetans had the will to do it, it's now become an economic problem because there are tens of thousands of Chinese who, as a result of Deng Xiaoping's reforms, are flooding up onto the Tibetan plateau and opening up businesses, private enterprise businesses. And you see them in tiny little towns out in the middle of nowhere. There'll be a Chinese shop or a store or even there's one karaoke bar that we visit in the film that where this guy's come up from because he can make money. So it means that what once might have been a situation that could have been separated had there been the political will or resolved had there been the political will is now a situation where there's such economic intertwinement that it becomes very difficult to imagine how Tibet could ever truly regain its independence or its autonomy.
Well, you're talking about Chinese merchants moving into Tibet and setting up everything from shops to karaoke bars. This was a policy that was encouraged by the Chinese to change the population of Tibet so there'd be less resistance to the occupation?
Well, I think initially the Chinese government was promoting a policy of immigration to get more and more Chinese to move to Tibet and in essence to thin out the Tibetan sort of ethnic density. But lately, I think it isn't so much the government who is promoting it actively as just allowing it. And now, since Chinese are able to move around China as well, they're no longer forced to stay in their hometowns where they have their household registrations by the necessity of getting, you know, ration coupons for food or clothing or one thing or another. Now they have money, they can move. And one of the things they're doing is moving to where they can make more money. They're moving to sort of become pioneers, much the way settlers in America moved out west because it was the land of opportunity, there was open space, and they didn't have so much competition.
I guess what's really ironic about this is it makes it seem as, you know, not makes it seem as if now that all these merchants are moving in, it's really capitalism that's going to be hurting the culture of Tibet as well as the ideology of communism.
Well, that's very true. And, you know, if you think Maoism and Buddhism collide and sort of miss each other, I mean, capitalism in a way is an even more extreme kind of extreme form of a sort of opposite worldview. And I think it's very difficult for young Tibetans to consider going into a life of a monastic life of asceticism and living in a cold monastery and eating a few balls of tsampa every day when they can be in Lhasa and wearing, you know, three-piece suits and going to the local karaoke bar and, you know, dancing till dawn. I mean, I can't tell you what a mind-bending experience it is to go along Happiness Road at the foot of the Potala, the Dalai Lama's winter palace, and see these acres of blinking lights and discos and video parlors and karaoke bars with nude girls from Taiwan videos. It just it makes you wonder how can this very fragile traditional culture ever survive this latest onslaught.
Is there a lot of tourism in Lhasa now?
There is, because not only are a fair number of Chinese coming up because with new wealth they want to travel and have a look around, but there are quite a few foreigners who come up and get jetted in on a tour and they stay at the Holiday Inn in Lhasa and they get bussed around to a few monasteries and are shipped out again. And this is very important to Tibet because they don't make anything. There's some natural resources, but there really is no other industry. So tourism is extremely important. And this has meant that the government, its good effect is that the government has seen fit to refurbish some monasteries and some holy shrines, but they control this only restoring some of the more prominent ones and limiting the number of novices that can enter and become monks and trying to circumscribe religion, because they view Tibetan Buddhism as the crystal around which nationalist sentiment and then the independence movement ultimately coalesce. So it's something that they need to embrace for tourists to boost their tourist industry. But on the other hand, they're extremely wary of it because it also is that point around which this anti-Chinese sentiment so easily coalesces.
I guess the answer is to turn Tibetan Buddhism into more of a theme park than a way of life.
Well, one really has the feeling of being in a theme park when you're up on the top of the Potala and you see these Chinese soldiers. You can rent Tibetan nomads' outfits, you know, little fur hats and chupas, these long cloaks they wear, and have your picture taken. And when you get to monasteries and you see, in a sense, that they are a kind of Epcot Center creation. They also have some life in them, but it's a toss-up, I think, in this modern world, whether the life or the theme park is going to win out.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Orville Schell. He's written several books about China. Now he's done a documentary on Tibet, on the occupation of Tibet, for the PBS Frontline series, and that will be broadcast this evening on most public television stations. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Orville Schell, who's written extensively about China. This evening on most PBS stations, on the Frontline series, you can see his documentary on the Chinese occupation of Tibet. You interviewed the Dalai Lama for your Frontline documentary. What was it like to talk with him?
Well, the Dalai Lama is an amazing man. I mean, he is... It's very ironic, I think, that Tibet, you know, has this wonderful leader, whereas, you know, most countries that have sort of a territorial base have horrible leaders. So here you have a leader without a country instead of a country without a leader. He has an enormous power because he is so guileless. He's so, his agenda is sort of so clear. He seems to be so disinterested in serving himself and has devoted himself to Tibet in a way that makes him, I think, an extraordinary sort of moral example for the world. I think everybody feels this. The question is, how can he be reinsinuated back into his land, which he left in 1959? The Chinese are very wary about inviting him back or having him back. But in fact, he might end up serving a tremendously positive function within Tibet in terms of keeping down the levels of tension and perhaps even controlling future demonstrations if some accommodation could be reached.
Could you explain China's territorial claim over Tibet?
Well, it goes way back to early centuries ago when the Mongols conquered Tibet and then the Mongols conquered China, and it was a kind of an inherited deed, if you will, through the Mongols. And you could argue about this for 1,000 years and you would change nobody's mind. The more important question, I think, is that regardless of what history may tell us from hundreds of years ago, one has to decide one's own attitude towards the right of any land that is culturally, linguistically, geographically separate to self-determination. And this is really what the Tibetan government in exile is asking for, is some sort of plebiscite to let the Tibetan people decide what they would like to do and what their relationship to China should be.
If we lose the Buddhist culture of Tibet, and by culture, I mean the religion, the architecture, the whole way of life, what are we losing?
Well, you know, there aren't too many traditional cultures of a sophisticated nature left on this world that still function in any real sense for ordinary people. I think in a certain sense, Bali is one exception, and Tibet is one exception. But Tibet has suffered a terrible, terrible blow from 1959 on, when the Chinese, quote, peacefully liberated Tibet through the Cultural Revolution, when most of the monasteries were destroyed. So the question is, can this culture revive itself and become another integral part of life there? Now, if it can't, what we really have lost is the center of a whole civilization, the very center of a society, because religion not only was the spiritual center of Tibetan life, but the monasteries were the social center. They were also the market centers. The whole of this society was constructed around Tibetan Buddhism and all of its various institutions. And so you basically would have a society that's gutted, and if it can be have a some sort of an organ transplant, I guess what it's going to get transplanted with is what's going on in China that we see through the lens of what's happening with Deng Xiaoping's reforms, you know, kind of a very primitive form of capitalism.
I think for anybody interested in religion, particularly in Buddhism, there's this terrible tragedy that a living religion that is so connected to the distant past would be smothered.
Well, this is why I think it's so important that some accommodation be reached that allows the Dalai Lama to return. Because I think if he does go back, or can go back, regardless of what Tibet's status ends up being, he might be able to assure that Tibetan Buddhism survives. He would be able to bring back with them all those cultural institutions that they've kept alive in exile, and I think would also be give a tremendous sort of boost, spiritual and moral boost, to the Tibetan people, who still look upon him with the most enormous fondness. And everywhere in Tibet, one sees pictures of him. People have them a little less secretly now than a year or two ago, but up in their shops and in their homes, and you can buy them in the streets, kind of, you know, behind the scenes. And everybody looks to the Dalai Lama as the hope, somewhat naively maybe, that if only he would come back, things would be all right, that he is the saving possibility for all of them, and all the only person who could help erase all the suffering and hardship that they've endured.
Orville Schell's documentary Red Flag Over Tibet will be shown tonight on most PBS stations on the Frontline series. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Orville Schell will be back in the second part of our show to talk about China's human rights record. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Orville Schell. His documentary Red Flag Over Tibet, about China's brutal occupation of Tibet, airs tonight on most PBS stations. Schell is the author of 8 books about China. In this second part of our talk, we focus on China's human rights record, its now booming economy, and its relations with America. China is up for its renewal of most favored nation trade status, and that it comes up for renewal in June. And President Clinton has to certify that China has made significant overall progress on human rights in order to renew the most favored nation status. How does Tibet figure into that?
Well, interestingly, until this year, until May, when the president's executive order was released, Tibet didn't figure at all. There were various questions of human rights that pertained to China, and presumably they also pertain to Tibet being part of China. But this year, he has specifically written language that says that the Chinese must show signs of having protected Tibet's unique religious and cultural heritage. So how they will judge this is, of course, another question. But it means that for the first time, Tibet is actually part of the mix. There has to be some judgment made about what has been going on in Tibet to protect Tibetan culture. And that is, in effect, why we made this film.
Because of the decision that has to be made in June?
Yes. We wanted to try and come to some assessment ourselves as to what the state of traditional Tibetan Buddhist religion and culture was, and whether that state warranted the president certifying that, signing off, in effect, on it and renewing China's most favored nation status this June.
What's your conclusion?
Well, I mean, my conclusion is that there hasn't been a tremendous amount of progress. I mean, there's sort of two aspects to it. One is the state of religion and culture, which I will say are not particularly robust. They have rebuilt a few monasteries. There are monks back in them, many less than before. But the monasteries are really dependent upon the state or on contributions from people. They can't expand very rapidly. They have very little independence. They're very circumscribed. And the second aspect, of course, is the state of human rights in Tibet, which is, I think, even more an even more grievous situation. Anybody who exercises even the most basic kinds of free expression, political expression in Tibet, is arrested and locked up. The Chinese are very, very nervous about such expressions, and they don't mess around. In the Barkhor out in front of the Jokong in Lhasa, I mean, one just feels this palpable tension because it is here that all the demonstrations in the past have either begun or ultimately ended up. It's Lhasa's Tiananmen Square, and there are all sorts of plainclothes police and security personnel posing as monks and surveillance cameras on the roofs of the buildings, scanning the crowds as they circumambulate around the cathedral or people who are there to buy things in the market. And this place is the place where most people end up being caught, arrested, and put into one of Tibet's numerous prisons, which have a long history of really just abominable conditions. And those two aspects, I think, are really what the president has to address himself to, the question of culture and the question of human rights violations and arrests of people who've exercised their rights of political expression.
Do you think that it's a good idea to tie economic openness, you know, like most favored nation status, with human rights policy?
Well, I think one has to decide, first of all, whether one believes the United States should have an active human rights policy. In other words, whether it is in our interest or is our moral responsibility to look after people who are abused around the world and who cannot speak up and look after themselves. If you think it isn't our responsibility, well, then it becomes a moot point. If you think it is, then you have to decide to what are you going to hook this policy. How are you going to pressure these countries into stopping torture, stopping arrests for political purposes, etc.? Now, if you don't believe it should be hooked to trade, then you've got to decide what it should be hooked to. And the reality is that we haven't really thought of anything else, and that MFN is something that was grabbed at the last minute after the June 4th bloodshed in Tiananmen Square. And it's a clumsy tool, yes. But it's a tool that I think I would be loath to see us put down unless we have some alternative.
Tom Friedman in the New York Times said that China is the world's biggest emerging economy. Threatening to break ties with China is like the U.S. holding a gun to its own head and threatening to shoot. Do you agree with that?
Well, I mean, to a certain extent, the U.S. certainly can't ignore China's economy. On the other hand, 30% of Chinese exports go to the United States. Now, any business that sells even 10% of its products to one customer has got to worry about that customer. So I think that if the United States is worried about shooting itself in its own foot, China should be all the more worried because they are much more reliant on us than we are on them. So that's just a reality, and I think we ought not to get too carried away with our own potential loss of trade and forget that China's potential loss is infinitely greater, and thus perhaps they will strive all the harder to accommodate. And I actually believe they will. Chinese are very practical.
We've talked about Tibet. What kind of grade would you give China on its human rights record and the rest of China?
Well, you know, after yelling and screaming and claiming that human rights was a question of, you know, domestic policy and we had no right to interfere, and that they would not heed such outside interference. In many ways, the Chinese have responded quite nicely. I think still the situation is pretty awful in China in terms of human rights abuses, but we have gotten their attention, and they have started to talk, and they have released prisoners. And more important, I think they are aware for the first time that the outside world is not just going to close its eyes and trade with them, that there is some higher goal, there is some higher moral purpose in the world than simply doing trade, and that sometimes it can cast a shadow, albeit sometimes maybe a very weak one. But this has been very important, and I think that the Chinese will yield more before June 4th, and I hope that they will be able to yield enough to enable the president in good conscience to say, well, things aren't perfect by a long shot, but we're making progress. Let's keep going.
My guest is Orville Schell. His documentary, Red Flag Over Tibet, will be shown tonight on most PBS stations as part of the Frontline series. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Back with Orville Schell. We read so much now about what a big market China has become. How did China manage to become this like booming economy?
Well, you know, I think China was so tired of being the poor man of Asia. I mean, first it was the poor man of Asia around the turn of the century, and then it was sort of the poor communist man of Asia that extolled sacrifice and living a Spartan life under the Maoist regimen. And when Deng Xiaoping finally began to open things up, people were so sort of starved for all of the things that come so easily to us as Americans. I mean, consumption and greed and lust and enjoyment, that they really just ran away with themselves. In 1992, Deng Xiaoping, who was undergoing a bit of a leadership confrontation with the old-style, hardline Maoists in the party, decided that the best way to save the party from further occurrences such as Tiananmen Square demonstrations was to allow people to become sort of transfixed by production and consumption. So he made a trip down to across the border from Hong Kong at the Shenzhen Special Economic Zone, and he started talking up marketization and privatization and stock markets and all these things. And that was a signal for the country to, in essence, to pull a ripcord, to do almost anything it wanted to produce. And since then, China has just been lost in this orgy of production and consumption. It's not too much, I think, to say that the animating force in China today is unalloyed greed. Now, having said that, I'll also say that I think to some degree this is good. I mean, people's standard of living is rising. It has injected enormous amounts of freedom into their lives because the marketplace is relatively free. What's not free is the political sort of marketplace. That is still very much in the hands of the party. So you have a kind of a Leninist capitalist, a kind of what some have described as a gulag capitalism, where economics has been reformed and has been served as a real palliative for politics, and the political structure remains essentially the same.
China is very much into consumption and production now. It's still an authoritarian country. What's left of the communist ideology?
Well, the communist ideology, I think you'd have to say, is in tatters. It's sort of kept around like a fig leaf over this new kind of marketized economy. And they can't abandon all of Maoist ideology without sort of destroying the party's own justification for maintaining unilateral political control. So they have to rule in the name of the proletariat, and they have to be for the dictatorship of the proletariat, and they have to view it as a government that's set up to protect the lower classes rather than the upper classes, even as the upper classes are being reborn and a new bourgeoisie is returning with a vengeance. Otherwise, why don't they have a different kind of government? So it's a terrible paradox, a somewhat comical paradox, and the rhetoric of communism becomes increasingly more ridiculous, as the society delaminates into rich and poor, and you have all these bizarre new affectations, and you know there's a great craze for lapdogs sweeping the country. You find aerobic studios, there are race tracks springing up, horse race tracks, and betting in most cities, and everyone has all these rich new young yuppies have cellular telephones and Italian suits. And on the other hand, you have the party sort of waffling on about the need to, for socialist spiritual civilization. It's very bizarre.
I want to get back to your Frontline documentary. Because you didn't feel you could go in as journalists, you went in as tourists and took basically home video cameras with you. But the tape that you shot included people saying things that they would have been imprisoned for had the authorities knew that they were saying it. How did you get the tape out of Tibet without any Chinese authorities looking at the tape?
Well, I mean, the Chinese are not checking all borders and everything. I mean, it would be impossible with hundreds of thousands of people coming in and out of the country all the time. The more interesting question, I think, is how do you get these kinds of interviews? How do you meet these people? And in Tibet, what is very striking is that as a foreigner, Tibetans just come up to you because they have no other confessors in this society. The Chinese don't want to hear them. If they do, they speak to the Chinese, they get arrested. And so one can be just walking through the streets and a Tibetan will come up and ask if you want to meet some ex-prisoners, some lamas in a monastery who were part of the independence movement. And they know that you'll be sympathetic, or they hope you will. And they know also this is the only way they have of getting their story to the outside world, which is through foreigners.
I might be a romantic Westerner here, but from the little I know about Tibet and the little I've seen in the way of film and still photographs, it seems like just physically being there could be a life-changing experience. Did it have a physical effect on you? Did the physicality of Tibet, the mountains and, the beauty of the place have any kind of big impact on you?
I mean, Tibet is an amazingly wonderful place. It's just spectacular. And when you're out in the mountains, there's just not a sound except the sighing of the wind. And you feel as if you are just as far as a human being can get from anything and still be on the earth. It's an incredible quiet, a kind of a peacefulness. It's so barren, the landscape is so sort of undisturbed with junk that one does have a sense of a minimalism that does concentrate the brain. It's a beautiful, beautiful place. It's also extraordinarily harsh and bitter winters and no trees. And the most amazing aspect, I think, of Tibet of all is the way nomads have learned to coax a grudging existence out of this barren, high-altitude plateau and to live as well as they have. And finally, you know, to be as happy as they are. It may be trite to say, but the Tibetans are just wonderfully jolly, guileless, funny people, and they love to mimic and joke. And after Chinese, who tend to be more formal and more suspicious and more even devious, the Tibetan guilelessness is just a wonderful, wonderful tonic.
Orville Schell, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
It's been a great pleasure, Terry.
Orville Schell's documentary, Red Flag Over Tibet, will be shown tonight on most PBS stations as part of the Frontline series. This is Fresh Air.